Our topic this morning, it's the last one of the sacrament topics. We did marriage last week, and today we're looking at divorce, remarriage, and the Eucharist. So I want to start with Jesus' words, recorded there in Matthew 19, verse 6, which read, "What God has joined together, let no one separate." You're very familiar with that text. Jesus said this in response to a question posed by the doctors of the law, the scribes, scripture scholars of the day, all male incidentally, who were debating whether a man, a husband, could divorce his wife for any reason at all, which was the current opinion of the younger leading rabbi called Hillel, or whether a husband could divorce his wife only in cases of marital infidelity, which was the opinion of the older Shammai. Two schools of thought. Every culture recognizes that marriage is important. Don't have to tell you that. It's not just important for the couple, but it's important for society. It's appropriate, therefore, to protect marriage by law. However, in accordance with the tradition which they inherited, the lawyers who were questioning Jesus accepted divorce as a male right. There was no question in Judaism of a woman divorcing her husband. It wasn't possible. Jesus rejected their assumption, declaring that a man who divorces his wife and marries another, and this is a quote from Jesus in Mark's Gospel, commits adultery against her. Bringing in a woman's right in this matter. Jesus also challenged them, and I think you remember the story quite well, to examine the purpose of marriage. God made human beings in God's own image and likeness. One way in which human beings are in God's image is when, as male and female, they enter into a love communion through which they continue God's work of creation by bringing human beings into the world. The relationship of husband and wife, therefore, is a sacred one, a life-giving one, love-giving, self-giving, life-giving relationship, to be protected by good law. This can happen only if those responsible for seeing that good law is upheld go to the heart of the matter. What is marriage for? So, the general principle enunciated by Jesus, which I gave you a moment ago, is quite clear. A problem arises, however, when we try to discern which sexual unions, quote, God has joined together. What God has joined together, people should not divide. But what sexual unions has God joined together? Well, clearly not all. Jesus is quoted as giving one example of a sexual union that is not joined by God when he goes on to say, and I'm using the New Jerusalem Bible translation because it picks up what scholarly opinion I think has now come to a consensus on, the meaning of the Greek porneia in this context. And it reads, "Whoever divorces his wife," I am not speaking of porneia, is the Greek, meaning I'm not speaking of illicit marriage, and marries another, it commits adultery. So he's already made one exception. Matthew understands that Jesus' words against divorce do not apply to any and every marriage contract. In the Jewish setting, he's speaking of marriages that are in accordance with the requirements of Jewish law, expressed in the book of Leviticus, laws which apply not only to Jews but to non-Jews living in the territory of Israel. And you find all that in Leviticus chapter 18. So non-Jews were not expected to follow the Torah, but there were different rules of the Torah which, for social cohesion, Gentiles living in there had to follow. One of them were the marriage laws detailed in the book of Leviticus. Now these regulations almost entirely prohibit incest. Sexual unions involving incest do not constitute a marriage, Matthew is telling us from Jesus. They can and should be broken. So already we have one example of two people who've married, but outside the Jewish law, and that's not a union that God has put together that can't be broken. So far, clear? Very simple. I'm starting you right from the ground up. Paul. So Jesus is now dead and risen. Paul never knew Jesus of Nazareth, but was encountered by the risen Christ after the resurrection. And Paul is writing to across from Ephesus in about the year 53, so 20 years after Jesus' death. He's writing across the Aegean to the community that he was with for a year and a half in Corinth. And in 1 Corinthians 7:15, he, having addressed his remarks to married couples who are both believers — I have to leave you to read this for yourself, it's too long to give the whole passage — Paul goes on to speak about a marriage in which one of the couple is not a believer. This is really terribly important for me to be clear on this. He's answering questions put to him by the Corinthian community. And under Corinthian law, either partner, husband or wife, could divorce simply by making a declaration before witnesses and registering the fact. Automatic divorce, either way. And if you read any of the history of Rome and the Roman-occupied territories through the first century, working out who was whose kid was is absolutely impossible. There was families all over the place. Marriages galore, divorces galore, etc. It was kind of terribly common. Well, common among the people who could afford it, perhaps I should say. So, in an earlier letter, Paul had told the community, and this is what they said in their request to him, not to associate with sexually immoral persons. That letter we haven't got, it's not extant, but it is quoted in this first letter, chapter 5, verse 9. We haven't got all Paul's correspondence, some of it's been lost, sadly. And they asked him, well, if we're not supposed to associate with sexually immoral persons, did this include a non-Christian spouse? Is the Christian obliged to divorce, perhaps, to separate themselves from a husband who's worshipping some other god, or refusing to allow the wife to live a good Christian life, or whatever? How does a person committed to the gospel live in a marriage relationship with a spouse who's not committed to it? Should he or she seek divorce? They're the kind of questions they asked. To such questions, Paul replied that the Christian party doesn't have to divorce. Doesn't have to. He goes on to remind the Corinthian Christians that through their faithful love, they may be instruments of bringing salvation to their non-Christian spouse. So he points out to them that being married to a Gentile, to a Jew, or to a non-Christian, could be an opportunity of grace to reach that person and invite them through their love and fidelity and beautiful Christian life to embrace the Christian way of living. That's kind of obvious, but that's the first point that Paul makes in this chapter 7. Well, what about when the Christian spouse is divorced by the non-Christian spouse? So the non-Christian spouse does exactly what you can do in Corinthian law: calls in witnesses, declares the divorce, registers it with the town clerk, and is divorced. What happens to the Christian spouse? He or she have to live like that for the rest of their life without marriage, without sexual union, without a family. No, what position are they in? And it's Paul's answer to that question that is our precise interest this morning. And he says in chapter 7, verse 15, if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such a case, the brother or sister, meaning the Christian man or Christian woman, who are called brothers and sisters in the Christian community, is not bound. It is to peace that God has called you. And that expression, not bound, has been interpreted as meaning that the Christian is not bound by the broken marriage contract and so may remarry. Here we have another situation very early in the church where Paul, and he says, I'm not speaking from the Lord, he hasn't got any kind of special revelation, but it's his wisdom and his advice, and say, no, I'm sure that's not what Jesus meant. So that marriage was not put together by God. Therefore it may be broken. Based on Paul's words in this text, the church came to see itself as having the right to dissolve a marriage contract between two unbaptized persons after the baptism of one of the spouses and the refusal of the other spouse to cohabit peacefully. It's sometimes called the Pauline privilege, and that's in place and has been all the life of the church. Clear so far? Quick history. I'm quoting here from an article by John Beale, B-E-A-L, a leading American Catholic jurist. I've got the article here. It's a whopping article. There's a lot been written on this in the last 20 years. Massive. So this is an article by him called Intolerable Marriage Situations Revisited. And the subtitle, Continuing the Legacy of James H. Provost, who was one of the leading American jurists, Catholic, but who died. And he, this man, and every 10 years, Provost used to keep people up to date, people like me if I had time to read it, with the latest writings from all the journals and the Vatican and everything, what's going on in the discussion within the Catholic Church on these issues. Well, he died, so Beale is continuing it. And this is, I'm quoting from The Jurist, volume 63, 2003, page 304. And he gives a quick historical breakdown of other instances where the Catholic Church has seen itself as free to dissolve a marriage. In the 12th century, and I haven't read this at any length, I can't say any more than I've got here, there came about, quote, a reconciliation of Roman and Germanic views of marriage, which led to the recognition of dispensing from a ratified but not yet consummated marriage. So, there's a marriage between two Christians now. And it's ratum, that means it's valid and it's sacramental, but not yet consummated. In fact, I know one of these from my own story, where the husband, they were married in the church, they came out from the church, and the husband said, that's the last time you'll ever enter a church. Prior to the marriage, having said, oh yeah, you know, everything's lovely, she immediately stopped. That was dissolved, because his intention in marriage was a lie. Do you get me? It was not consummated. They hadn't yet come together as husband and wife, and because the partners of the sacrament of marriage is not the church. The priest is a witness. They offer the sacrament to each other. They'd promised to offer it, but they hadn't yet done it. So that's ratum non consummatum, if you want the Latin. And since the 12th century, it's been recognized that that can be dissolved. Now, the missionary context occasioned by the age of discovery, colonialism, and the slave trade prompted 16th century popes, so we're now in the 1500s, Vasco da Gama and Cortes, and you with me, the New World and all that period, to stretch traditional principles to fit new pastoral realities. Okay, so they went to Africa or they went somewhere and this man had five wives. Well, in Christian setting you'd only have one. Well, I think they just let him pick which one he wanted as long as the other four, whatever. But there was different, they call it the Petrine privilege now, meaning exceptions had to be made going into a polygamous society and all that. Complicated, and I don't know, I used to, but I've forgotten it. But the fact is there, did you get it? There are other marriages that can be dissolved. And in the 20th century, getting close, the church recognized its power to dissolve non-sacramental marriages in favor of the faith. So, it's a non-sacramental marriage. One of them becomes a Christian, and not always and not automatically, but you can dissolve such a marriage in favor of the faith. So if she then, having become she, becomes a Christian, a Catholic, say, and then the marriage is very destructive or difficult or it's impossible, and she wants to marry into the faith, then it can be arranged and done so. So that's the historical setting. So, the conclusion to this is, this historical thing, is Canon 1141 of the recent Code of Canon Law, and it defines the only marriages that the Church considers beyond her power to dissolve. I'll be talking about this for the rest of the morning, so this might sound like the end, but it's only the beginning. The only marriages, and here it is, Canon 1141, a marriage that is ratum, meaning valid and sacramental, et consummatum, defined in Canon 1061 as the validly married spouses have, quote, performed between themselves in a human fashion. We're not talking about rape here. We're not talking about anything like that. But they've performed among themselves in a human fashion a conjugal act which is suitable in itself for the procreation of offspring, to which the marriage is ordered by its nature and by which the spouses become one flesh. That's the way canon law defines consummatum. So, back to the canon. A marriage that is ratum et consummatum can be dissolved by no human power and by no cause except death. That's the current church law. The rest of this paper, lecture, examines the discussion that's still going on in the church about what kind of pastoral care can be given to persons whose marriage is judged to be valid, sacramental, and consummated, but who have been divorced and remarried in a civil ceremony. If they were divorced and got a nullity and remarried in the church, there's no question, you see. So we're talking about someone who divorced from such a marriage, ratum et consummatum, and then remarried in the civil ceremony. What can the church do with such people? How can we welcome them and so on? Well, begin. Canon law distinguishes two separate situations for those who've been divorced and remarried. This is the language of the jurists. One of them is called the conflict situation, the other is called the hardship situation, and I'll define them for you. The conflict situation, in which the previous marriage is objectively invalid. It's not ratum. It wasn't valid. He never wanted children. He never told her. And when they married, she suddenly finds she wants children. He doesn't want any. He doesn't care about having children. Never did. So when he said, I want to give you myself to you forever, till death do us part, part of the marriage contract is openness to children, by definition. And she suddenly finds he's not. So his promise was invalid, do you get me? She was at home, 18, with a very dominating father, met this bloke from Ethiopia, I don't care where, who loved her, cared for her. She ran away from home to get anywhere away from home, and married him without due discretion, is the word used, without due maturity, without realizing what was happening, only to find herself in a second hell. Okay? It was lack of due discretion. She it's like me, if I bought a car and suddenly found there's no engine under the bonnet. I didn't have a look. I thought, oh, well, all cars would be okay. So I didn't look, and I find I've got a car, I've paid for it, but there's no engine in it. Well, someone's done me in, do you get me? So the contract wasn't mature and wasn't valid. All right. So the conflict situation in which a previous marriage is objectively invalid, but for some reason it's not possible to prove this in the church's external forum. Tribunal. You can't prove it, but it is so. Well, before God, the person is in fact free to marry, but not in the church, hence the conflict. Clear? That's one situation, common situation. The second situation is the hardship situation, in which a valid marriage, so it is valid, ratum et consummatum, but it's broken down irretrievably. And one or both parties have remarried outside the church. The situations are not the same, but they're both needing care. The discussion over the past 25 years, you're getting right up to date from today, as up to date as I'm able to bring you from my extensive limited look at this subject. Are you ready? The discussion over the past 25 years has drawn on the following statement of Pope John Paul II in his post-synodal apostolic constitution on the family. Popes issue encyclicals every now and then. We just had one not long ago from Deus Est, God is Love, from Benedict. But the church also, every 4 years, I think, has all the bishops of the world come together to Rome at a synod, and they discuss matters. Then the discussion is handed over to the Pope and his helpers, of course, to put together into a document, and that's called a post-synodal apostolic constitution rather than encyclical, because it comes from a different source, though it eventually comes from the Pope. Well, in the one after the family, Synod of the Family, which was in 1980, I think, and in 1981, Familiaris Consortio was published from Rome, and this is written by Pope John Paul II. We're talking about 25 years ago. Here it is. Included this statement. Persons must know that for the sake of truth, they are obliged to exercise careful discernment of situations. Pastors, he's talking to people like me, parish priest or somebody. Careful discernment. There is, in fact, a difference between those who've sincerely tried to save their first marriage and have been unjustly abandoned, and those who, through their own grave fault, have destroyed a canonically valid marriage. There are those who've entered into a second union for the sake of the children's upbringing, and who are sometimes certain in conscience that their previously and irreparably destroyed marriage has never been valid. We're back to the conflict situation. So that was a quote he gave, which encouraged jurists, bishops, cardinals, theologians. They were already doing it, but this was an encouragement to make some distinctions and to be careful not to just put everything into one blob and treat everyone the same. However, in that document, he went on to affirm the Church's traditional discipline of not admitting the divorced and remarried to the sacraments of penance and Eucharist. So he was quite firm on that, and that was the Church's position, and in an official way, it has remained that. And the jurists say that we've gone backwards since 1981, not forwards. That's the sadness of it. But I'm going to dare to take you forward. In 1994, getting up close, 12 years ago, three German bishops, Sayer, whom I don't know, Lehmann, whom I do, who was the the bishop in charge of all the bishops of Germany, like their official representative, K. Caspar, Walter Caspar, who post this was made a cardinal and is now the cardinal in ecumenism, wonderful, intelligent man, and, well, made a cardinal anyhow, later. So these are the three men. They were in one of the regions of, I think, the Rhineland region of Germany. They issued a pastoral in 1994 in which they acknowledged the church's discipline as being generally valid. Well, if you're going to make a general statement in accordance with what Jesus said, well, a valid, consummated marriage between two believers, the presumption is it's real. And so it stands. And so if you break it, the presumption is that you've put yourself outside the church and therefore you can't come to communion unless get a tribunal, etc., etc. Got it? So that's the generally valid. But they added, it cannot regulate all of the often very complex individual cases. If you want to find this document, there's the reference. Origins is the big regular, comes out weekly, I think, from the United States with all the bishop or episcopal statements and so on. This is volume 23. It might be once a month. I've just forgotten. I haven't. And 1994, you'd certainly be able to get it on the web. And that's the statement they made. They go on, these German bishops, to speak of the conflict situation we've talked about. They don't call it that, but that's what they're talking about. And they say that in each individual case, it needs to be determined whether the generally valid discipline applies. Something which, they say, cannot be generally presumed, especially when those involved have, based on good grounds, satisfied their consciences of the nullity of their first marriage, but no legal proofs exist to obtain a declaration of nullity from an ecclesiastical tribunal. What a wonderful statement to be making. They also touch, in that pastoral letter to their people, on what's called the hardship situation, referring to, quote, an insoluble conflict of duty, where leaving the new family would be the cause of grievous injustice. So, I've been married validly, everything's, I then, outside the church in a civil union, marry another person. Are you with me? We have children together. We've built a relationship together for 10 years. The children need me as their father. I've promised things to her. Do you get me? So can I just walk out on that in order to go to confession and back to communion in the church? Is that a just thing to do? Are you with me? So that's the situation we talk about. The heart. They talk about that. Now, they suggest a number of pastoral processes. It's quite a long article, pastoral. And the possibility, they suggest, that the marriage partners, or perhaps just one of the partners, may see their conscience clear to approach the table of the Lord. Okay? Canon lawyers speak of this. This wasn't the origin of the idea, but it had never been given a higher profile than this. It's often called the internal forum solution, the conscience solution. And that's what's still being discussed in the journals. However, this idea received an immediate and authoritative rejection from the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith in Rome. So it's a highly powerful statement and was immediately rejected by the CDF, of whom the prefect of that, of course, is our present Pope when he was Cardinal Ratzinger. So in Origins 24, etc. And this is the quote from that statement from the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, and this is the quote you find in the Catechism, in number 1650. So the Catechism presents this as the teaching of the Church. And it reads, in fidelity to the words of Jesus Christ, the Church affirms that a new union cannot be recognized as valid if the preceding marriage was valid. If the divorced are remarried civilly, they find themselves in a situation that objectively contravenes God's law. Consequently, they cannot receive Holy Communion as long as this situation persists. A strong rebuttal of the statement of the German bishops, and that was got out the next month in October 1994. Can you hold all these ideas in your head for me to continue the logic? Another canon of canon law, you're enjoying this, I hope, number 915, states that those who are not admitted to the Eucharist, this is what stops a person coming to the Eucharist, any of us. It quotes, those who obstinately persist in manifest grave sin, grave mortal sin. So you've done something which is objectively cutting right across faith and morals of the church, and you obstinately persisting in it. Well, you can't, obviously, no one would deny that, approach communion. Now, scholars, you'll find a lot of this if you look up all the stuff, debated whether this canon applied necessarily to divorced people with a civil marriage. Is that a situation where you've got people obstinately persisting in manifest grave sin? Some canon lawyers said yes, most of them said no. The debate went on. However, that too was nicely knocked on the head by the Pontifical Council for the Interpretation of Legislative Texts. Again, from the Vatican, on June the 24th in the year 2000, it stated, I'm now quoting from a little bit later from the same article of Beale, but this is just a summary of it, stated that this canon does apply to the divorced and remarried. So the people whose responsibility it is to interpret the meaning of canon law said, no, it means these people. Please don't get upset, I'm going to take you on a lovely journey soon. But this is, oh, you've got to know all this to be able to understand what I'm wanting to share with you. I want to give you church teaching, do you get me? As honestly and as truthfully and as balancedly as I'm able to do it in this complex matter. However, this statement from the Pontifical Council for the Interpretation of Legislative Texts must be treated with great care. Canon lawyers remind us that there is a carefully worked out discipline for determining the meaning of the canons of the church's law. Beale writes, if the words of the church's law mean whatever a church authority wants them to mean at a particular moment, we are perilously close to abandoning the rule of law in the life of the church. Follow the logic. And that's why I did it earlier, I can't do it again now, it would be inappropriate and I haven't got the time. Why we just have to know, at least know in general terms, somebody has to know in very specific terms, there is a craft, a discipline called theology, where there are criteria well worked out, as there are in any scientific, medical, whatever discipline, for heaven's sake. There's a system of determining things, a hermeneutics of understanding of what you're doing. Has to be. And when we talk about church law, church, what's the church teach, and I have done this with you on an early occasion, what the church teaches is a whole lot of concentric circles. If you're talking about infallible statements of faith, then if the church makes an infallible statement based on faith, and it has all the criteria of infallibility fulfilled in it, you know, that the theologians put there, I have a choice. I can leave the church or I can obey. I can't play games and think I know more than that. Do you get me? So I must believe them if I believe. I must say, well, my poor mind can't see it. My poor little brain isn't big enough to see it. But inspired by the Spirit, guided by the Spirit, an infallible statement has been made by the church. Well, for God's sake, I believe it. But if it's one of the outer circle of statements made by particular people who happen to be in the Holy Office, which is what we're talking about here, or if we're talking about Galileo back in the 16th century, 17th century, whatever it was, I've forgotten, or if we're talking about, do you get me? The Vatican's made enormous mistakes for a long time in many areas, in non-infallible areas. Non-infallible means fallible. Fallible means could be wrong. So where it could be wrong, there has to be debate and discussion. So the statement here of the Pontifical Council is clear. Is it right? We give it respect, but we look at it very carefully and must. Canon lawyers have this, canon lawyers, jurists, have this statement. They talk about canonical equity is the English translation of the term they use. And again, I'm quoting from this article here, which is by Beale. Unfortunately, I looked it up on the web, and it has it on the web, but when you press the thing, the address won't work. So I can't give you a website to find this particular article. Don't know why, because it's all there. You'd expect it to be there. There's some mistake in the business. So, canonical equity means it requires that the diocesan bishop actively intervene to apply the law in a way that does not allow it to be a crushing burden, but an occasion for divine mercy. In this way, canonical equity ensures that the law retains its vigour, it's clear, it's not wishy-washy, and it's not saying do what you like, it doesn't matter. That's me, that bit, sorry. It retains its vigour while ceding to the demands of the salvation of souls, which is always the supreme law of the Church. And I'll be returning to that again. So, let's have a little look at valid and sacramental. All agree that faith is necessary for a marriage to be a sacrament. I've given you the Church's teaching as best I can. Now this is me. Take it, leave it, think about it, do your best with it. But all agree that faith is necessary for a marriage to be a sacrament. Okay? Today, one cannot argue that a baptismal certificate is proof of faith. Some argue that since the Church can, in certain circumstances, dissolve a natural marriage, a marriage not between believers, the Church needs to discern carefully in the case of a marriage breakdown of a baptized non-believer. Now, there's been no encouragement of such thinking from the magisterium. So you won't find that question being asked in any of the statements that have come out of the Vatican that I'm aware of or that anyone I read is aware of. But I'm asking it, and you've just asked it, and it's clearly a question we need to attend to. Paul did say in that Corinthian correspondence, it's to peace that God has called you. So this encourages us to ask further questions. What is to happen when one believing spouse gives up the faith, in fact, if not in theory, and makes it impossible for the other believing spouse to live his or her faith or to experience peace in the marriage? Fair question. Well, as I see it, there's no substitute for doing exactly what Paul himself did in the passage that we quoted. We have to examine the actual situation in the light of the nature of Christian marriage as a sacrament of God's unfailing love and attempt a wise, compassionate, and realistic discernment. An analogy that's used by some might attract you, it may not. It's recognized in the case of the Eucharist that when the consecrated bread or wine lose their nature as eatable bread or drinkable wine, they lose their significance as a sacrament. That would rarely happen, but you understand what I mean. Let's say we had a mass and we were keeping the Eucharist, and then something happened, machine guns came in, the priest had to flee, people had to flee, and people came back in a hot climate many times later and saw what used to be bread, but it's no longer bread. Well, it's no longer the Eucharist. It's not as if Jesus is getting mouldy. Do you get me? It's only a sacrament when it is a sign of edible bread. That's why the crumbs, we're very careful, of course we are, in picking up everything. But once the wine, for example, was spilt into the cloth on the altar by accident, a drip of it or something like that, and it soaks into the cloth, it's no longer drip wine you can drink, is it? It's no longer the blood of Jesus, because it's not wine. We're not talking about physical and chemical changes here. We're certainly not talking about magic. We're talking about symbolic communion. Right. So you know that, I hope. Well, if the bread is no longer bread, it's no longer the body of Christ. If the wine is no longer wine, it's no longer the blood of Christ. And Beale writes, page 303, if this traditional doctrine is applied analogously to marriage, one could argue that when the spouse's love is so corrupted or destroyed that it's no longer capable of signifying the faithful love of Christ for his body, the church, their marriage has ceased to be a sacrament. I'm not saying that. I'm thinking it, do you get me? And they're thinking it. And it doesn't sound too far out to me. If that's what marriage is, a sacrament of Christ's love for the church, a destructive relationship may have been a sacrament, but it no longer is. And if it's no longer a sacrament, can it be dissolved? Question. Are you following the question? I'm not going to give you an answer, because I'm not in that position to do so. Now, fidelity to love can mean the cross. We're not talking about a bed of roses. All you people who are married know more than I. Priesthood's the same. I mean, we're not talking about stay a priest as long as it's easy. God, I'd have left 45 years ago or whatever it is. Probably, you know what I mean? You know, we're not talking about ease here or the fact of darkness or struggle. We're talking about crosses. But there's only one cross on Calvary redeemed the world. The other two didn't. And people, you've got to, what is this cross? Well, not every cross is redemptive. And a question, can remaining in an unloving relationship that's destructive be described as being faithful to married love? Good question, surely. Keeping faith can, in some circumstances, demand heroic love. A love that's only possible through grace. It can mean dying to oneself. But we mustn't lose sight of Jesus' teaching that such dying issues in life, though difficult and at times painful, it is not destructive, but life-giving, and its fruit is love. And I know, you must know people who've stayed in a very difficult marriage and are saints and really extraordinarily loving people. I know them, so you must. So, Jesus isn't commending, however, a waste of life or a destructive disregard of self. One doesn't have to go on being abused because one said one would marry in a sacrament at the altar. Being a disciple of Jesus does not protect a person against the ordinary situations of hurt or misunderstanding or being the victim of another person's infidelity that are part of the human condition. The fact that two disciples of Jesus pledge their love to each other in faith does not guarantee them against marriage breakdown. Love doesn't control. And one partner cannot prevent the sin or the infidelity or the breaking of the covenant by another. Since our call in faith is always made, moving on a bit now, I presume what I've said now up to now sounds reasonable. Now, since our call in faith is always made and responded to in community, and since the sacraments are celebrations of the community, the body of Christ, we're not left to make such discernments on our own. The community is there to assist us in determining the status of a marriage within the faith community. And this is the aim. Always it'll be done imperfectly because it'll be done by people like me. But this is the aim of the marriage tribunal, set up by the church, hopefully in the hands of intelligent, sensitive, experienced people. And it's there to help me in my marriage, or you in yours, work out what's going on. If, as a member of the faith community, a person opens him or herself to the discernment of the community exercised through the tribunal, and the community judges that what may have appeared to be a sacramental Christian marriage was not in fact so, for reasons of lack of due discretion or fear, or I've given you a couple of examples, the person has the support of the community in divorcing and is free to remarry, and remarry in the church with great celebration and at last build a sacrament. Since one's status within the faith community and therefore one's rights and obligations are a matter of determination by the community, not the individual, one should seek the determination of the community insofar as this is possible. It's not always possible, but insofar as it is. Of course, the discernment of the community is not the only discernment that is to be made. Invalid. They may be able to do that. Well, they have to answer to God for that. You can't just say, oh, well, the church said it was okay. We can't do that in any situation. You can't do it in this one. So you and I, each of us, has our conscience, and we must stay. That's final before God there. If for whatever reason, however, it's not evident to a tribunal that the first marriage was not a consummated marriage, sacramental marriage, and don't blame the church for that. You may not be able to make it obvious. You may not be able to get the witnesses to say it. And all the church then says is, well, look, I can't say it was invalid. I'm not saying it wasn't or was. No one can say that, except the person involved, I guess. But all we're saying is, well, we love you, we care for you, but we can't support you because we can't just pretend, and we haven't got the evidence to support it. So from the point of view of public law, public forum, it looks like a marriage that's ratum et consummatum, and that's as far as we can go. Now we're back to you. Truth that can't always be made evident. One is still free to make a personal, conscientious decision in the matter. And a person may, in good conscience, decide that his or her marriage was not put together by God. But they can only give their own point of view on it, and their partner may challenge it untruthfully. So, and there may be no one to witness to it, because only who except the couple know what they went through. You are following my point, are you? Today, I'm not telling you anything, I'm just thinking out loud. You've got to know this. Today we're witnessing in society a shift in people's understanding and expectations of marriage. Increasingly, marriage is seen as a commitment to an interpersonal relationship of love. Well, just go back a few hundred years and marriage had a lot to do with inheritance, didn't it? A lot to do with family honour, a lot to do, and it was arranged by the families, and that's not a bad thing to do, and some cultures still do it, and they seem to be much more successful than our so-called romantic. But anyhow, whatever of all that, all the cultures have got different things. Marriage can be quite a complex affair, but today, surely, in my part of the world anyhow, increasingly marriage is seen as an interpersonal relationship of love, a commitment to that. Elements of this shift have deep Christian roots and have been nurtured by the church's teaching, though it's not always evident that the church has integrated this shift fully into her legal procedures. Marriage remains a contract, a covenant, but today there's a heightened expectation that the commitment is to what Vatican II calls, quite beautifully, a partnership of love. The church has always taught, believe it or not, that the main purpose of marriage is the love of the spouses. A secondary purpose is children. But sometimes that would have sounded like the other way around. It never should have been, but some of the documents could be read that way. But the church's teaching is, of course, it's the love of husband and wife and their communion that is the primary purpose. And the fruit of that please God, his children, and who are brought up and educated and share in the faith and love of the community. So it's a partnership of love. That's what you promise at the altar. The spouses rightly enter marriage with the intention of committing themselves to such a partnership. They promise such a partnership to their partner, and they understand the marriage vows as a similar commitment to them from the partner, the male or female. Human experience demonstrates that not every commitment to marriage is wisely made, nor sustainable. But the ideal is there, and the hope, and many a couple have been helped by this fact to go through dark periods into a more mature love. I would know many, you would know many, who've gone through, and priesthoods are similar, separate but similar. We go through dark places, and if we can hold on to love and faith through it, we can often come through to a much more mature and beautiful place. The Church rightly teaches that if the promise can be kept without involving oneself or one's partner in destructive behaviour, it's a serious betrayal of trust.